Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Shamrock. I'm Pete Sampson, joined as always by Matt Fortuna. Today's special guest, a name if you're in the college football industry you know very well, Tim Beray, a Notre Dame graduate, 40 years at Clemson in media relations. We had a great interview with him talking some insights about Dabo Swinney, what makes him tick as a Notre Dame graduate, what it was like to be up in the press box on November 7th watching his alma mater go against his employer, and looking ahead to Saturday. So that's our second segment. We'll be back with a second podcast later this week. We've got another pretty cool guest name you will be very familiar with. But look, this week was there's a lot going on around Notre Dame outside of the ACC championship game, and frankly, there's nowhere to start but Clark Lee, our favorite podcast guest, our favorite co-host. Look, it's he accepted the Vanderbilt job formally on Monday night. He will stay with Notre Dame through the ACC championship game and presumably the college football playoff. Presumably meaning Notre Dame makes the college football playoff, not presumably whether he would or would not. Matt, I guess what was your reaction when you found out Clark Lee was off to Nashville, his alma mater?
Part of me is saying what took so long, because this opening was there for over 2 weeks, and I think from the minute it opened, we all knew he would be or should be one of the top choices. I know Lance Leipold from Buffalo and a couple other guys were in the mix, but just happy for him. I mean, he finished runner-up for BC last year. He's a guy who, as you've written and said many times, like, just speaks with such a reverence for his hometown, for his alma mater. To get to do that at a Power 5 level as your first head coaching job before the age of 40, that's pretty special. That doesn't happen really at all in this business, the way the stars align that way. So I'm happy for Clark. It leaves some pretty important questions for Notre Dame moving forward beyond this season. We'll get into those as well. But, I'm just happy for him. He was no sure thing when Notre Dame promoted him after the 2017 season. I think a lot of people probably thought it was a bit of a lazy hire just going internal, because, as we'll see here, the defense coordinator position at Notre Dame is a prime post. It pays well. You work with good kids. You work for a good boss in Brian Kelly. You get a lot of freedom. And even then, there was the anxiety of he's never called a game before. Mm-hmm. And after three seasons, two of them perfect in the regular season, with not nearly the raw material to work with that, the Nick Sabans and Dabo Swinneys of the world have on their sides from a future NFL five-star signee rankings. The guy's the real deal, and I think those skills translate perfectly to a place like Vanderbilt.
I totally agree. I mean, we've talked about Clark as a head coaching candidate before, and I think he would have success most places. But I think he is tailored to a very small group of schools: Notre Dame, Northwestern, Stanford, Vanderbilt, Boston College, Wake Forest, Duke, programs like that, where academics is not just sort of like, yeah, we have a great graduation rate. It's something that is culturally built into what they're trying to do there. So this is, I think it's a super smart hire by Vanderbilt. I think that you and I had probably exchanged some texts early on, like, do you think he would take it because of all the hurdles that you have to clear at Vanderbilt organizationally? Not the academic restrictions, the fact that your athletic department and the facilities are in sort of a major rebuild mode right now. And you sit there and think about, like, well, wait a minute. They're not creating new Power 5 head coaching jobs. They're not creating new SEC head coaching jobs. Like, of course he would take it. And, you know, Vanderbilt's in a position where they probably need somebody who really, really wants to be there, opposed to somebody who has to be convinced to be there. And Clark Lee may be the only candidate who would check those boxes for Vanderbilt. So it's, I think, an incredibly smart hire by them. It is a real blow to Notre Dame moving forward, because I think that, look, Notre Dame has had to replace coordinators before. Sometimes it's worked out, sometimes it's been a disaster. But Brian Kelly's on a pretty good run of hiring assistant coaches right now. I think that will probably continue, but this is the most important hire on his staff. He has enough oversight in the offense that he feels like he can fix things if they need to be fixed. But defensively, is that there's a lot more autonomy on that side of the ball. And I think, as we saw with Charlie Weiss in his 5 years here, if you're an offensive coach, can't get the defensive coordinator right, you really got no shot. And, you know, Diaco, Elko, Lee were all outstanding. Brian McGuire, obviously the opposite of that. And really, that if you want to understand how serious this hire is, like, think about how close Brian Kelly's tenure at Notre Dame may have come to ending because of the Van Gorder hire and just how messed up that was. Notre Dame is obviously in a way healthier position now than back then. But to hit at the highest level, to be a college football playoff regular, you really need to find the next Clark Lee. Maybe he's on staff. Maybe you got to go out and get him. But that's Notre Dame cannot win a national championship without a Clark Lee quality defensive coordinator.
Agree completely. One of the guys you mentioned, I think we've talked about, and I'll be curious to see if they kick the tires on him, bringing him back. And we'll talk about candidates here at length. But do you think there's an opening for Mike Elko to come back?
Yeah, probably not. But it's a call Brian Kelly has to make. I don't know why you wouldn't. It may be a 5-minute conversation. I do think it's important that people realize, like, Brian Kelly and Mike Elko, like, I'm not saying they're like best friends, but considering how that ended and how there could have been some animosity between them, there's not. They're plenty cordial and get along. And it would be interesting to give Mike Elko a truth serum on this. Like, the job at Notre Dame now is so much better than the one he took in 2016. You know, the coaches that came to Notre Dame after when the 2016 season ended, everything was like a 1-year contract at that point, regardless of what piece of paper you held in your hand. Because if they didn't win in 2017, everybody was out of here. They did, and things stabilized, and you sort of see what's happened next. But, you know, Elko could come back here. I do think he's a much better cultural fit for Notre Dame than Texas A&M. You know, and I believe that we've probably both heard some rumblings along the way that, like, A&M is maybe tough place to be, but right now they're sitting there at one loss in that top five, so it's probably a little bit better situation than it was just a year ago for him down there.
If Notre Dame beats Clemson this week, Elko's going to be in the playoff. And he's probably get more bonuses and more money than he's already making. And I don't know. I think it was probably a bit of a tough adjustment getting down there at the ground level of a coaching regime that got a 10-year, $75 million contract with crazy expectations that they're only now starting to meet. But he's done a really good job there.
Yes.
Really good job there. We talk about Clark Lee. Mike Elko was a finalist for the Boston College head coaching job last year. He was a finalist for Temple the year before. I don't know, unless you're like really miserable, and I have no indication that he is, I don't know why you would leave for what's essentially a lateral move back to somewhere you'd already been. I'm happy to hear that they're on good terms. I mean, I heard a lot of different versions of the story in real time when he did leave about, hey, Notre Dame just wasn't comfortable going to the lengths that Texas A&M was from a financial commitment versus, hey, Notre Dame promised him a lot of negotiations that they didn't live up to on their end, mostly by a guy who's not there right now, who's, I believe, somewhere in the NFL, former operations guy. But, bygones be bygones, I guess. I get why we're talking about it. I just have a hard time understanding what would be in it from Mike Elko's standpoint, from a career growth standpoint, from, you know, another option standpoint. Mm-hmm. Again, he's had head coaching opportunities and has chosen to stay where he is. And right now they're they're rolling. I mean, they're in a really good situation right now.
Yeah, I think the head coaching opportunities is probably an underrated part of who would be willing to come if you're outside of the Notre Dame sphere already. Because if your goal is to be a head coach, coming back to Notre Dame for Mike Elko is not going to get you there any faster. It may even slow you down a little bit. But there is a candidate at Cincinnati, Marcus Freeman, who has serious head coaching aspirations, as he has gone on the record to say. You know, one of those is at Cincinnati. If Luke Fickle moves up to Michigan or some other big-time job, I think coming to Notre Dame to be defensive coordinator wouldn't necessarily speed that up if he wants to stay at Cincinnati. However, to me, that is the candidate I want Brian Kelly to probably kick the tires on the most. The one that I want him to really sit down and say, like, all right, what is your structure? How do you coach it? How do you recruit it? How do you fit what we already have? Because I don't know. When it comes to these hires, I much prefer the guy that's on the rise in the industry taking a chance on him, opposed to sort of been around the block. Like, experience is good, don't get me wrong, but I like the up and comer. I think we've seen it work out with Elko. We saw it work out with Lee. We're watching it work out with Tommy Reese right now. You know, those hires are very appealing to me. And, you know, Marcus Freeman's a linebackers coach. You're replacing your linebackers coach there. I think an awesome recruiter. Obviously spoke very highly of Mike Mickens when he joined the staff a year ago. They worked together at Cincinnati. They were high school teammates. I don't know if Freeman would do it. Certainly the financials would be much more palatable for Notre Dame than they would for Mike Elko. But that's, to me, that's the candidate I really want Brian Kelly to get in the weeds with and see, like, okay, is this a possibility?
Yeah, I think he should be the first choice or first attempt, if you will. I do think if Luke Fickle had left for Michigan State last year, which would have been in February after the second signing day, especially that time of the year, I think Marcus Freeman was in great position to possibly become the head coach of the Bearcats.
Well, yes.
Last year, who, you know, I think it would take a lot of dominoes, a lot of creative thinking on the minds of the committee, but we're also talking about a team that might be in the playoff this year. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen, but, like, they're as close as a Group of Five team has ever come and probably ever will come to reaching that pinnacle. So he's in a good situation right there. And Luke Fickle is going to be mentioned for every big head coaching opening as long as coaches get fired, which is going to happen as long as there's college football. So it'll be interesting to see the domino effects there. But, I mean, Marcus Freeman is – I would even call him a rising star. I know he's young, but I think he's a star already. I had to fill out my Broyles Award ballot, and both him and the guy I would like him to replace were on it. Don't worry. As was Mike Elko while we're on the subject. But I think the world of the guy from afar. I think he's really, really impressive. And, you know, you mentioned it. The guy on the rise is always, I mean, outside of BVG, who obviously didn't work out, I don't know if Kelly has gone to the proven goods, but the been there, done that, not guy on the rise yet. And I think every single coordinator he's had became a head coach after Notre Dame. With the exception of maybe Mike Dembrock?
Yeah, I think that would be accurate.
Dembrock and BVG.
Yeah.
I mean, Walt Molinar, UMass, Diaco, Martin,
Sanford. Clark. You know, Reese
yeah.
will be.
Elko, there's yeah. the one who hasn't. Yeah.
But yeah, Elko's doing quite well for himself, even if he's not a head coach. Yeah, you know, internally, Brian Kelly has done that before, certainly did it with Jeff Quinn as the offensive line coach. I don't know where his head is at with sort of maybe a Mike Elston, Terry Joseph combination hire or combination promotion. That's how it worked out with Reese and Lance Taylor a little bit last offseason when Chip Long was let go. But I don't know. This just – I don't feel like that scenario and this scenario are – similar enough to look at how Brian Kelly handled that last year and say that's predictive of how he's going to handle it right now.
Yeah, the situations are different. I have a hard time kind of articulating how they are different, but they just are. I mean, there are people at Notre Dame who've said to us, or at least to me, like, Kelly wanted to promote Elston after Mike Elko in 2018 and not Clark Lee, and a couple people stepped in and he ended up promoting Clark Lee instead. I mean, look, Mike Elston, especially this year, I mean, I think you could argue when you look at the talent on that line and the way they've overperformed this year. I mean, you could argue this is the best coaching job he's done in his career. I mean, and he's had some good, almost dominant defensive lines at Notre Dame. He's been really, really good in the role he is in. He's been Brian Kelly's right-hand man. Does that make him Notre Dame's next defensive coordinator? I don't know. But I also think it's fair to ask if he wants it and he doesn't get it. I mean, it's kind of tough to stay in one place 11 years and not get the kind of promotion that you probably think you're worthy of after this time, that others probably think you're worthy of at this time. So I think there are some interesting dynamics there as well. But I don't know how you don't at least, conduct an actual search. I mean, even with Tommy Rees, who we all thought would eventually get the job, I mean, Brian Kelly did talk to Todd Monken. He talked to at least one or two other guys. He at least did his homework and, checked the market and saw what was out there. And conversely, there was a market for Tommy Rees. Tommy Rees interviewed at Oregon. He interviewed at Northwestern. I don't know.
That's the difference probably, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean,
Rees was in demand in a different way than Elston would be.
Hey, when the NFL firing season comes around in a couple of weeks, maybe having this conversation again about Notre Dame's offense coordinator, because we all know Tommy Rees has a lot of roots and a lot of connections in the NFL. And with the NFL being a copycat league and seeing Cliff Kingsbury and Matt Rhule coming in there and kind of rethinking the traditional organizational structure. I'm not saying Tommy Rees will be an NFL head coach, but I think he'll definitely have some looks as a play caller the way Joe Brady did last year. So we'll see. But this is the position you're in when you're a playoff team. And I saw some people asking you on Twitter, how do you do both? Ask Jeff Scott at Clemson. Ask Jeff Hafley at Ohio State. Ask every single Nick Saban coordinator since the end of time. This happens all the time. And unless you're Lane Kiffin and you're going to burn every bridge you have on the way out publicly, it really isn't the kind of distraction for a program that everyone kind of assumes it will be. And I think that will be even less of a distraction this year because Clark Lee's not going to be flying back and forth between Nashville and South Bend for signing day because everything is virtual this year and you can do everything from your office or your home.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that. It's I have no hesitancy at all. And by the way, yes, Charlie Weiss, how that works. Like, he won the Super Bowl. He was Notre Dame's head coach. If Bill Belichick can make this work, Brian Kelly can make this work.
Bill O'Brien, who used to be a good coach.
Exactly.
lost the Super Bowl, but...
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The one thing is there was so much uncertainty on Monday as we're figuring out, okay, what's happening? Is this official? Is it not official? Is this basically down to dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Like, the one thing that I was certain of was that Clark Lee was going to stay at Notre Dame through the end of the season, assuming Notre Dame's in the college football playoff. And he texted his players on defense yesterday. Like, one, he apologized that this got out on social media. That's not how he wanted to do it. And then he said that the only thing that he cares about is the next 3 weeks. So, I thought that was an important part of Vanderbilt's release on Monday night, that Candace Story Lee spoke.
Lee hiring Lee. I'm surprised the puns aren't just flying.
She said, mentioned Clark Lee's obligations to Notre Dame and how important that was to him. And that's really, if you want to distill Clark Lee down to one thing, which would be a disservice to Clark Lee because he's way more interesting than one thing. But if you did, that would be it. Like, it, he is about sort of group loyalty and the success of the group, often or occasionally at the expense of any kind of personal gain or personal glory. I just don't think he really cares about that. He's kind of an ego-free coach in a business where egos are mandatory and sometimes unbelievably oversized. But for him, he's kind of the opposite. So that that was why I felt incredibly confident that he would be sticking around, and he will, for the next few weeks.
Here's Xavier Vanderbilt. What better advertisement for your downtrodden program than to point to the college football playoff in a couple weeks, or maybe the national title game in a couple weeks, and have the ABC broadcast gushing about your new future head coach as he calls a potential national championship winning defense?
Like, yeah,
that's perfect. The best advertisement you can ever get.
I was reading through Vanderbilt's stuff last night, and the what they're saying about Clark Lee, they had Mike Tirico and Tony Dungy. I'm like, why not Pete Sampson and Matt Fortuna? Do we not have the same cachet?
Too close to the sun with one of us.
Yeah, it's. I mentioned this on Twitter last night. Like, every Notre Dame assistant coach who's come on this podcast is now a Power Five head coach. And then I was like, wait a minute, Brian Kelly may see that as a negative. We may never get another assistant on this podcast if we have the ability to move them on to greener pasture so quickly.
Our guest we have on today has an award named after him, so we're really on a roll right now. By the way, I almost forgot about this because we haven't seen him or been to a practice since the first one in spring during these crazy times. As we were talking about Mike Elko possibly coming back, completely different situation, but Kerry Cooks is back at Notre Dame in an analyst role this year after being a co-defense coordinator and secondaries coach during the national title run in 2012 and through to 2013. That was the one, and again, hindsight's 2020, but he was co-DC with Bob Diaco. They did not promote him. They hired Brian Van Gorder, and Kerry ended up leaving, I think, a year later to go to Oklahoma. And look, we could play the alternate history game and drive ourselves crazy all we want. I say this because BVG was just so bad that I just think if you promoted Kerry Cooks or frankly anyone on that staff, it would have been better and you would have had a playoff team in 2015 when you look back at the talent on that roster and how much it was wasted by bad coaching. That's not to say, hey, you should do internal this time, but I think there are some cases where it can work. I just think if you're Notre Dame and you're in the position you're in right now, You've got to kick the tires and see what's out there and see what the interest is.
Yeah, it's like you can't be afraid to take a chance on somebody that you have got a good feeling about if you're Brian Kelly. And I think that's why we probably are both in agreement. Like, you want to see Marcus Freeman get interviewed if he's interested. I'm assuming that he would be. And if he fits sort of the room that you have here. I put out a list of names today. I think John Haycock at Iowa State is somebody that Notre Dame has looked at before.
Your favorite school.
Yeah. Jay Bateman, somebody Notre Dame has looked at before at North Carolina. I think those are a lot more like potentially steady hires. I don't know if I would go there over sort of an Elston Joseph combo. Marcus Freeman, that's the one that I'd be like, all right, if this guy fits our room, maybe this is the move to make.
Mary, and look, you have some intel there from Mike Mickens as well. And
yeah,
some
absolutely.
Continuity, if you will. So I think that's possible. They do play each other next year, I think.
They do.
Which is also interesting. Although I don't think Marcus Freeman's going to be at Cincinnati either way. I think he's going to be head coach somewhere.
In 2021?
Coordinator. I think he could get hired as a head coach this year at a smaller program,
yeah,
maybe.
That's true.
Defense coordinator at Notre Dame.
Coaching carousel got really weird in the last week, so it's possible.
It's gotten really weird, and I think it'll get weirder since we're still waiting for a few more very big dominoes to drop in the SEC and Big Ten. But Andrew Thacker is another name that I think, from my understanding, Notre Dame came away very impressed with the work he did in their game against Georgia Tech, especially considering the talent disparity between the two teams. I believe his father was Deshaun Watson's high school coach, or there was some connection there in Georgia, but that could also pay dividends on the recruiting trail as well. He's an up-and-comer. He's only about 35 or so. But, hey, there will be a number of options for Brian Kelly to look at, and I'll be curious to see how he manages that part of it. I mean, we talk about how Clark Lee is going to manage both. How's Brian Kelly going to manage preparing a playoff team while filling out his staff? And he took his sweet old time with the OC last year. I was literally getting on the plane leaving New Orleans the day after the national championship game when they announced that Tommy Rees had gotten the OC job. And again, that was after Rees had interviewed a couple other places and Kelly kind of disappeared to Florida and no one knew what was going on. But he kind of marches the beat of his own drum, and to his credit, whatever he's doing is working, especially this year. Before we get into Tim Beret, big news for Notre Dame's conference of 2020. Maybe it's conference of the future. I doubt it. Jim Phillips, Northwestern Athletic Director, is now the ACC Commissioner. He'll start in February. He spent 4 years working under Kevin White at Notre Dame as an assistant AD in the early 2000s. Now I'm in Chicago. I know Jim. I know Northwestern. The guy is one of the smartest men I've ever met in college athletics. He should have been the Big Ten Commissioner.
Yes.
I think we were all shocked when that didn't happen. Probably worked out for the best for him, seeing the turmoil that's gone on in that conference and knowing that he's going to work at another Power 5 conference where I hate to say it's an easier job without knowing all the dynamics, but there's a little less pressure. It's a little more agreeable, better at basketball usually, and frankly competing for more national football titles lately than the Big Ten has. But I just think it's the perfect fit. I know people at Notre Dame are thrilled about it because you know, you've written this, you've said it. I got asked about this a number of times yesterday. Oh, well, he worked at Notre Dame. Maybe he can convince them to come on in full time. No, it's the complete opposite. If you've worked at Notre Dame, if you know the place well, you know how much that place values its independence. You know how valuable that property is as an independent. You know how valuable that property is from a television deal if they're just playing 5 football games a year in your conference. Jim Phillips is from the Kevin White tree, which is probably the biggest tree there is in college administration. He worked with Bubba Cunningham. He preceded Boo Corrigan, all of whom are athletic directors in the ACC right now. So as much as they went outside the Carolina roots, if you will, there's still a lot of internal influence guiding this next generation of leadership for the ACC. But I think it's a great hire. I think it's a great hire if you're a Notre Dame fan. And we'll see what happens moving forward around the country with realignment, TV deals, and so forth. But I just think it worked out perfectly for the ACC.
I agree. And, you know, very well for Notre Dame, too, because it's like, could I see Notre Dame ultimately joining the ACC in full? Yeah, I could see that. But if it happens, I doubt it's not going to be because the new commissioner of the ACC is on an ego trip to make it happen just to say that he did. You know, and that I think would probably be a little bit of a concern of Notre Dame that you're going to have a Pat Narduzzi take in the commissioner's chair would be like, all in or all out.
Commissioner, let's pause for a moment and picture Commissioner Narduzzi. If you thought Kevin Warren and Larry Scott were fun to laugh at.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and Jim Phillips, I talked to him at Big Ten Media Day in 2017. I went up to Chicago just to sort of to hang out and connect with some people. So I talked to Jim Phillips, talked to Sandy Barber, because they both have Notre Dame connections and roots here. And Jim Phillips flat out said Notre Dame is exactly where it's supposed to be, as an independent but linked up with the ACC. Maybe that opinion changes a little bit. It's actually a story that I want to write for Thursday, and I've got some interviews set up with people at the ACC on Tuesday to mine it. And this will be undoubtedly the highest rated ACC championship game of all time. It may even jump the highest rated Big Ten championship of all time.
Well, it's not competing against it this year.
Yeah, there's that, but it's like the ACC has been such a third place championship game. Fourth place. But this year it's, I think, clearly the best. That never happened.
After Florida laid an egg, you could say complete clarity.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have stuck the SEC number one. But the SEC and the ACC are not in the same time slot. I think the ACC has a chance to absolutely kill it. So I'm curious how much money this would... If the ACC looks at that and says, like, oh, how much would a $13 million views of our game be worth in a television deal? And is that worth putting the screws to Notre Dame in a little bit different way? I don't know the answer to that, but I'll be curious on Sunday, Monday to see how many people tuned in for Clemson Notre Dame Part 2, because I think it's just going to be a massive number that dwarfs anything the ACC has ever done and probably will trump most Big Ten championship games as well.
Yeah, I would think so too. I don't know what the long-term dollar figure is that you can put on that. I know they're tied in pretty lengthily right now with their current deal, especially with the ACC network. But as we've seen, especially this year, a lot of those things are subject to change. I mean, the state of affairs in the Pac-12 right now, I mean, I can't sit here with a straight face and say that league will exist as it currently is constructed 10 years from now. Like, I don't know if you can say that about anyone with the rate that this world changes, but the Pac-12 is very, very vulnerable right now. And, you know, that leads to a domino effect elsewhere. It's tough to really gauge what everything will look like. Now, I do think for all the good things we just said about the ACC, there are people a lot smarter than us in the industry who think their TV deals with ESPN right now are crap, and they need to get out of them, and they need to negotiate something better. And obviously you can negotiate a stronger hand when you have arguably the biggest brand in college football at your disposal as a full member. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's going to be Jim Phillips' first order of business. No. Not sure he'll be anywhere near the top. I'm sure he'll hear from some people who are unhappy. But I don't know. I mean, I'll be fascinated to monitor how this looks, because you got the Big Ten rights deal coming up pretty soon. The SEC just signed with ESPN, and people probably don't realize they signed for their original deal with CBS for like 10 cents on the dollar. CBS had like the most one-sided deal in the history of college athletics. It was the best bargain ever. It was arguably the best brand on Saturdays at 3:30, famous intro, SEC on CBS Saturday afternoon game. That's not going to be the case anymore. I don't know how CBS approaches things moving forward, if they're ready to dive in headfirst and pay the kind of dollar that you're supposed to pay in the 2020s. But I don't know. I mean, that dictates everything, that's for sure. When you look at the way the dominoes ended up falling and why things are the way they are right now in college athletics, why Nebraska is unhappy with the Big Ten and the Big Ten's unhappy with Nebraska, all this can be traced back to TV money, Longhorn Network, Pac-10, Pac-12, Pac-16, you name it. And I think that'll be worth monitoring in the years forward, especially with the fissures that were brought out by the way COVID was handled by different conferences, and especially because, frankly, and I hate to say this, it's been a little quiet in those realms the last 5 years or so, and things don't stay quiet and calm for too long in college sports.
No, they definitely don't. All right, well, we'll wrap it up segment one there. We're going to get to our guest, Tim Beray. Some really good anecdotes and insight on Dabo Swinney and what makes the Clemson program tick. So we will get to that now. And then just a reminder, we'll be back for a second podcast later this week with an A-list guest and predictions on Notre Dame Clemson. Although, as a teaser, this guest will not be able to make a prediction on that game.
He will, however. We didn't get a chance to ask about this. I'm always fascinated by how this man's brain works, because he's just like a walking encyclopedia of college football. He's the man who pointed out before the 2015 game, the Hurricane game between Notre Dame and Clemson, that it had been 1,977 weeks since they last met in 1977. And later that year, when Clemson played Alabama for the national title, which they hadn't won since 1981, he pointed out it had been 1,981 weeks since Clemson won their national title. We did not get into that kind of trivia with him. You could follow his Twitter account for like the most obscure, fascinating nuggets ever. But that's the kind of guy he is. He's awesome. I hope you guys enjoy the interview.
Pleased to be joined by a very special guest this morning, Tim Beray. 40 years at Clemson in media relations, 30 years sort of running the shop down there, as we were joking about before we hit record. He's seen some things, and a Notre Dame graduate on top of that. If you were following on social media on November, I guess, 6th, and saw photos of Dabo Swinney posing in front of statues on Notre Dame's campus, Tim was the one pointing them out, guiding that tour. Tim, I guess, welcome to the show. And then tell us about that tour. It's very rare that you get to give sort of I guess, a modern day Newt Rockne, a tour of one of the original Newt Rockne's.
Great to be with you guys. And yeah, those pictures in that day kind of told you all you need to know about Dabo Swinney. And I have a lot of friends, obviously, from Notre Dame. I think they got a kick out of it and had an appreciation, you know, for him. Dabo's a guy who really follows college football, has an appreciation for the history. And this was the first time he'd ever been to Notre Dame. And he told me, I can't believe that all my years in college football, I hadn't been to Notre Dame. And he said, I'd love to see the campus. Can you give me a tour? I thought, I was kind of blown away. I said, wow, how are we going to fit this in with, you know, everything so structured on a weekend for a coach when they go to a game on the road. But he looked at his schedule and he decided he wanted to take the team to the stadium, which he usually does when we go to a stadium where the players haven't been to, just so they get a feeling for the place. And so we worked it out that after the walkthrough on Friday, he broke the team up after that meeting. Interesting to point out, he encouraged the players to go get their picture made in front of Touchdown Jesus, that this was a special place that they needed to have that memory. So we went outside the stadium. We took his picture in front of Newt Rockne's statue, which, of course, Rockne's the winningest coach in college football history on a percentage basis. Dabo's 14th. So I told him he needed to get his picture made with Rock. So anyway, I got in a car and I'd gone over to the main gate ahead of time and made sure I was going to be able to drive on campus with my car, because even dating back to when I was a student at Notre Dame, unless you said you had a meeting with Father Hesburgh, it was tough to get on campus. But she let us on, and so we went over to the grotto and got out and went to the grotto, and he lit a candle for his father, which you know, had great meaning, because his father had died just a couple of months before the 2015 Notre Dame Clemson game. And that was a game his father always wanted to watch, because his father grew up a Notre Dame fan. His father grew up an Alabama fan, and Alabama had always had heartbreaking losses to when Bear Bryant was the coach. So that was such a meaningful game to him. And so if you see video of Dabo at the end of the 2015 game kind of being emotional, that's why it was, because he knew that game had so much meaning to his father. But brought him up to the Golden Dome, brought him inside the church, walked around inside the church, then went over to Soren Hall and showed him where Newt Rockne lived as a student. He got a big kick out of that way back in 1913. So we then concluded the tour before we went back to the hotel by going by to see Digger Phelps at his house on Piashway Street. And Digger knew he was coming. So they had met each other at the Dick Vitale cancer benefit the year before. So that was good. They could reconnect. So it was a fun day for me, and I think for Dabo.
I've covered that program in some capacity or another for 10 years. I think Dabo Swinney saw more of that campus in an hour with you than I think I have in 10 years. There's probably a way to find out the answer to this question, but I really would love to know how many Notre Dame students reported Dabo to the Mass Police on campus when you were tweeting photos of him taking selfies the day before the game so that he'd be sidelined for the game. But how much does, I mean, obviously you've worked with him his entire Clemson coaching career. How much grief does he give you, especially now, ever since this ACC arrangement with Notre Dame? I mean, Notre Dame Clemson has turned into a pretty consistent high-level matchup. I mean, what are those weeks like, you know, this year notwithstanding with the campus visit? How much is he really digging into you?
Well, he actually, at the press conference for the 2018 game, they had a joint press conference. They asked him about Notre Dame's tradition and facing it, and he kiddingly pointed to me in the crowd and said, oh, I know more about Notre Dame tradition and history than I care to know, because of Tim Bure having worked with me for all these years. So he really doesn't give me any dig. He has great respect for Notre Dame's program. He takes great joy when Clemson has beaten Notre Dame because he knows it's a huge win for the program and really adds to the you know, to the culture of the program, really winning games like that. So he doesn't dig at me that that much about the game. He's pretty into it just in general, but he does in general, as I said, have great respect for the program.
As somebody who's sort of been around Dabo and like really some big moments in his career, I mean, how does the national perception of him match up with yours? Because I'm asked that, I think Brian Kelly's national perception is over here, but I think people who know him would say like, actually it's quite a bit different. Do you see Dabo as a little bit more like what you see is what you get, or how have you sort of gotten to know him, describe him as, you know, when the cameras are off, is he about how he is when the cameras are on?
He's the most genuine coach that I have been around in any sport. And if you want to say what you see is what you get, then if you want to term it that way, but he really is. There's nothing you know, fake about him. He's very engaging with anybody that he meets, which, you know, probably is the national perspective. Obviously, there were some things over the summer that took place that you know, I was disappointed in the picture people might are having of him, you know, nationally. But he really is. He's just a terrific person. There's no other way to term it.
We've spent a lot of time, especially this year, comparing the programs. You know, Pete had a story a couple years ago about Clemson staff or administration visiting with Notre Dame's administration, and there were some ideas being exchanged and so forth. I don't know if anyone in America is more excited about these teams playing twice in a year than you right now. How similar are these programs based on your knowledge of both, your experience with both? How different are these programs, and why does what works for one may not work for the other?
They kind of met in the middle over the years. You know, when I first came, when I graduated from Notre Dame and went to Clemson, you know, Notre Dame was the number one, you know, really national program, and Clemson was just trying to. It was really a regional school academically and athletically. But Clemson has really grown academically into a top 20, 25 public, you know, institution. And when you look at graduation rates and APR scores and things like that, you know, Clemson is getting closer and closer, you know, to what Notre Dame always has been. And, you know, as a result, I think the type of kids that they are recruiting now are similar. I mean, I think, you know, it used to be Clemson had to beat South Carolina and maybe North Carolina and Georgia for recruits. Now it seems like Notre Dame and Clemson are going head to head with the same type of student athlete that they are, you know, pursuing. But I think the talent level is certainly, you know, on a par. And like I said, when I left Notre Dame, that wasn't anywhere near the case. And then the last couple of years, it seemed people looked at Clemson as being a more talented team, but obviously Notre Dame has done great things in recruiting. And then when you look at the records of the teams, you know, Notre Dame with four straight 10 win seasons and Clemson trying to get there. I mean, obviously has a streak of 9 in a row going, looking to get to 10. I do think there's just a lot of similarities.
I want to ask you, obviously, we talked about the tour, but like how you process the game on November 7th. Because I think I might have seen you up in the press box with the athletic director. But how was that to take in? It's been a while since you've had like a singular rooting interest in Notre Dame. And it, as we mentioned, 40 years at Clemson has a way of maybe changing some perspectives. But what was that game like to watch?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. It was a lot more difficult my first year in 1979. In 1979, when I went back to Notre Dame as assistant SID at Clemson, I mean, I knew still there were still a lot of Notre Dame players that I knew very well. Rusty Lish was the quarterback in that game. Mm-hmm. In the summers of 77 and 78, when I worked in the sports information office for Roger Valdeseri, at the end of work, twice a week, I would go play golf with Rusty Lish. We both lived in Morrissey Hall. We split pizzas together, you know, late many, many nights. So that was a lot more difficult for me because I knew a lot of the Notre Dame players. You know, now, obviously, I still root for Notre Dame and follow the program closely. But I really don't know Brian Kelly. I really don't know any of the players. And as I kiddingly said to people, Brian Kelly didn't give me a golf cart with a Notre Dame and Clemson logo on it when I retired. But Dabo did. It's a fun game for me because I know so much about, you know, both teams, and that part of it is a lot of fun.
Are you allowed to use that golf cart this week, or is that in hiding? And on that same line of thinking, what was your best memory as a student at Notre Dame? You saw some good stuff there.
Of course, it's kind of cold right now to play golf. So, in fact, I just got back from work in the U.S. Women's Open for NBC. So I haven't had the opportunity to use it lately. I was at Notre Dame at a great time from 73 to 78, 1977, 78. We won the national championship in football, went to the Final Four in basketball. Win over Texas in the Cotton Bowl was, 38 to 10, was just a terrific way to end that season. And then being the only Notre Dame team to go to the Final Four in basketball, was a terrific experience too. Plus that was also, I ran bookstore basketball, in those days. And that, May of 78 was the year it was featured in Sports Illustrated. So that was a lot of fun to go through too.
One thing I was curious about with you is, you know, when you're in sports information or athletics communications, you're there to help present the story of the program that you're working for. Notre Dame has, you know, historically, you mentioned Roger Valdeseri. I mean, I'm not going to say he could create a Heisman contender out of anybody, but pretty skilled in that department. So I wanted to ask you about Trevor Lawrence and Ian Book, because I think Notre Dame is in a position right now where they would like Ian Book to be mentioned as a Heisman contender if Notre Dame wins this weekend, which is a little bit tricky. And then you hear Dabo talking about Trevor Lawrence, who's missed some time this year, obviously with COVID. That's a little bit tricky as well. So how, as a SID, as a pro in that industry, how do you try to present cases for those guys if that's your job to do?
Well, the role of the SID in Heisman promotion has really changed over the years. Roger basically, you know, he never did brochures or crazy things. I mean, Roger was a person who picked up the phone and talked to people. When I first worked in sports information, I'd said that I noticed Roger was always on the phone. I said, man, he's always on the phone. And then when I became full time and did this, I said, well, now I know why he was on the phone. He was creating relationships and, you know, did that job better than anybody. Today it's a little bit different, and with all the different social media platforms and so many games are on television, nothing happens in anonymity these days. So, the SID really just has to, when he writes his game notes or now on Twitter and the help of your social media team, you know, all you can do is put out, you know, the positive, things that the person has accomplished, that you look at historically or certainly in that season. So really all you can do is just present the facts and then it'll go from there. The thing that's frustrating for an SID about the Heisman voting is you really don't know who's voting. I mean, you could probably figure out 150 of the 800, but still that's only, 20% of the voters. So you really have to just hope you get, positive national, exposure for your guy.
You also have the Tim Bure Award named after you for yes. Which the ballots, I believe, are due this week. I got my email from Ross Taylor over at Clemson for the most cooperative player with the media. I deal with a lot of programs. I don't say this just because you're on here, but Clemson's always been beyond media friendly. Obviously, the SIDs, such as yourself, have a lot to do with that. Dabo Swinney's a guy, like you said, is kind of like what you see, what you get. But did you – he's been in that seat a long time. His profile has obviously grown a lot as Clemson has elevated from a regional contender to a national champion. How much teeth pulling do you really have to do with him? Or is he a guy who, at least from the outside, looks like, you know, the more the merrier? I mean, the guy probably could keep talking forever if someone didn't cut him off. Like, how much work did you have to do – with managing his time and making him understand, you know, the off-field duties of that job?
Well, he kind of came ready-made. Obviously, I was the SID for, you know, right from the get-go, his first day as interim coach. He leaned on me some, but having been at Alabama, such a high-profiled program, and being a disciple of Gene Stallings, he kind of got it when it came to the media. So I really didn't have to do a lot. He and I communicated very well, still do to this day. And I think, you know, just talking things out, but he understood the importance of the media and does today, and the importance of the national media. So many coaches, so many athletic directors today think that through all your own platforms that you can, you know, create your own, you know, brand and all that. But I still think it's just 50%. Your image is still created by the outside media. I mean, even your fans know that the outside media, if they write something positive about your program, they don't have to. And everything that you put out yourself, you know, they understand that you're just going to give the positive side of things. So I think when an outside media member writes something about your program, like a Matt Fortuna and Pete Sampson, then, you know, that's, it's got more value.
We had Grace Rayner on our podcast for round one, who does a great job covering Clemson for The Athletic. And we were talking a little bit about, you know, the culture building that Dabo has done down there. And she gave us some good insights on that. And I was, you know, you've sort of seen it from ground zero to where it is today. Like, what has he done so successfully? Every program talks about culture and how important it is, but like, why do you think it's clicked it such an elite level there, where that's really what Clemson is known for now. And it's something everybody wants, but very few programs actually are able to do it.
Well, yeah, it all starts with Dabo. And to me, it goes to his first press conference that we had when he was named the interim coach on October the 13th, 2008. And it wasn't anything pre-programmed. He just talked about, you know, being all in with the program. He has a positive outlook on things, but he also doesn't blow smoke. He's very honest with his with his players, and you know, that's the first thing. You know, and you know, you hear so much about the family atmosphere and all that type of thing, but you know, it really is kind of genuine. And actually, that kind of goes back to when Dabo was an assistant. You might have noticed that the movie Safety has come out this week, which was a story about Ray McElrathby, who was a player at Clemson when Dabo was an assistant, 2005, 2006. And it talks about how the whole team kind of came to his support to help, you know, raise his younger brother. And so that type of, atmosphere, I think could a small thing like every Wednesday night, he started having these dinners with the families of all the assistant coaches would come, and they'd have dinner with the team. And so the players would hang around with the kids of the coaches. And so I think that's actually had something to do with it. And the other thing, though, is I think he's created a aspect of everybody respects everybody. Everybody respects everybody else's job, whether it be the cleaning person or whatever. You know, he worked out getting national championship either rings or pendants for the women who cleaned the building at the Reeves Center in 2018. So he's all about inclusion. I think the fact the way he treats the walk-ons in the program kind of contributes to the team unity aspect of things. So there's a lot of things that he has done, but having a sixth sense about people and, you know, who is a fit for his program as a player, coach, and administration has contributed to it also.
You mentioned the movie Safety. I'd be remiss not to ask. You were at Notre Dame the same time as Rudy Rudiker. Any stories from back then? Any stories from 2 decades later when people actually realized who Rudy was?
Yeah, you know, the one thing when I look back at, I was actually at that game. That was my first year working for Roger in the 1975 Georgia Tech game. So I was actually at the game. So I get a lot.
Who played you in the movie?
I was just up in the press box keeping stats. But the thing I remember about it, some of the things that, you know, Rudy lived in an apartment in the Convocation Center. He didn't live in the stadium like it is in the in the movie. And so Rudy actually on Sunday nights we had this big room in the back of sports information, and there was a television set in there, and we used to sit in there and put the release together. 2,700 releases we had to collate and staple to send to mail out in those days, and it had to be at the post office by 9 o'clock on Sunday night. So Rudy would actually come and sit in there and watch television with us. Didn't help that much, but once in a while he would staple a few releases for us. But I certainly got a kick out of that movie, and I got a great kick out of I was one of the ones who helped a bit from the university standpoint with the movie Safety. I got to read the the script ahead of time for people wanting my thoughts on it. So it really is a good the Safety is a good movie, and I think it will do for Clemson what Rudy did for Notre Dame, the movie.
I remember seeing you tweet that out. It's like, it's amazing to me how Notre Dame is still recruiting players who have seen Rudy. Like, it's, you know, it's a movie older than they've been. It came out before they were born by a lot now, but it still really resonates. So yeah, I'll be curious to see if Safety has a similar impact on Clemson. Not that Clemson really needs much of a boost these days.
Well, you know, we'll see what happens. Yeah. But yeah, I think it is a good depiction of this too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting down there again in 2023, because one of the great disappointments of 2015 was not being able to actually see Clemson because the weather was so bad.
Right. Yeah.
So I hear, you hear really good stuff about it, but it's, it's been, I don't know, rivalry might be overstating the Notre Dame Clemson series, but it does feel like a regular appointment viewing college football game now, where there's some expectations built in that it's going to be high stakes and well played, certainly after what happened on November 7th. So maybe we'll get you out of here on this. What will you be looking for on Saturday afternoon in Charlotte? We won't ask you for a prediction, although you're retired, so I feel like you're free to give.
I do work for the Clemson Radio Network.
You're retired and you work more than we do, so yeah. Go on.
Well, to me, you know, the key is always been turnovers in these five games that have been played. The team that's won the turnover margin has won the game all five meetings. And not only that, it's been a plus 14 turnover margin for the team that's won the game. So I think that's going to be a huge key. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see if Clemson's defense has significantly improved from the first meeting, getting the three starters back. And plus, there were six defensive starters out of the lineup when Notre Dame made that 91-yard drive at the end of the game. So it'll be interesting to see that impact. I can't believe that Trevor Lawrence is going to have a better game than Yui Ungalale had in the first meeting. But, you know, maybe there were some decisions on some plays. Maybe the fumble play by Travis Etienne, you know, maybe with the experience of Lawrence, he doesn't give the ball to Etienne in that play and run something different. So, you know, that was obviously a direct 7-point play that was a result of a mistake. So it'll be interesting to see. But no, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be another close game.
Company man, well said. By the way, I meant to ask, I've heard privately from some people you work with, but who was more upset when Ian Book was on ABC during the Virginia Tech Clemson game? You guys or NBC?
Yeah, boy, I got a lot of texts reaction about that. The Clemson fans were pretty upset. I mean, I kind of, you know, understood it from the standpoint that ABC is thinking, well, you know, that was such a highly rated first game, and all the Notre Dame fans are going to be watching because they want to see what Clemson's going to do if they win, you know, to get to that game. But it was a bit long, as I remember. He was on there for quite a bit time. I had some Clemson fan tweet at me, says, so in quotes, "So now, Ian, what's your favorite food? Who was your favorite teacher when you were growing up?"
He looks more comfortable in the pocket against Clemson's defensive line than he did sitting in his living room trying to talk during that game.
I kind of agree with that. Yes.
Yeah, maybe that gets back to the unique ways you try to stage a Heisman campaign in 2020. Have a takeover of the Clemson Virginia Tech game by Notre Dame.
Well, actually people got to see Ian Book. That's, you know, if you know, that's one thing with the Heisman, you want to get exposure and name recognition. So that was one way of doing it.
Definitely. Well, Tim, we really appreciate you making some time for us to chat about, you know, the Clemson program, pull back the curtain on Dabo Swinney a little bit, and look ahead to Saturday afternoon, because it's this series has been great. It's amazing that Notre Dame Clemson is going to play more often than Clemson against some ACC opponents, but I'm all for it because I love good college football games. I know you do too. So thanks for taking some time to chat with us today.
Yeah, I look forward to those future games too. It's great to be on with you guys, two of the true pros of the business, and you guys do a great job covering Notre Dame and college football.
Appreciate it, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks.